rocket built by SpaceX. And actually, the other countries are involved with new rockets too. You've got Russia. They've been using the Soyuz for decades, driving three-man crew. Now they'll be able to send up six-man crew. They have something called the Prospective Piloted Transportation System. And I guess the Russian version of the Orion. They'll be able to put six astronauts on board that. They've got a new rocket that will be, they'll be used to launch that thing. And in fact, they've got a new spaceport that they're building that they broke ground on there about a year or so ago, or 2 years ago. And that's eastern, far eastern Russia. And if you look at the map, it doesn't look like it's too far away from Alaska. So that's pretty much it, Dick. You don't have much more than that. The Starry rocket, the AMS that you brought up, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, and a communication blackout from Mars, as well as the future of commercial space space endeavors. Back to that, WS2N.
Good information, Paul. The blackout of the sun is an interesting phenomenon. When I was using my television receive-only terminal, the so-called 10-foot diameter dish, to receive a 4-gig downlink satellite, synchronous satellite transmissions, while I was doing that back in 1985 to around 1995, and now a modern-day 18-inch diameter satellite receiving system, KU-band satellite receiving system, again, although the frequencies are different, every geosynchronous satellite is directly above the equator. And twice a year, from the Earth's point of view, the sun crosses through the equator. It goes through the equator on the way north in the springtime and back again through the equator on the way south during the winter, at the beginning of northern winter. When that sun goes through the equator, for an hour or so every day, when you're looking at a synchronous satellite, your antenna is aimed at the satellite, but directly behind the satellite is the sun, as the whole Earth and satellite system slowly rotates once for 24 hours. That sun is a half degree diameter ball of gas at around 6,000 degrees Kelvin, surface temperature. The actual chromosphere is actually a million degrees centigrade, really hot. Let me drop. In order to make your 4-gig satellite receiver system real sensitive, you had a low-noise gas-fed front end running at around 20 degrees Kelvin. In other words, as far as the amount of radio noise it created, it's equivalent to a 50-ohm resistor, 20 degrees above absolute zero. That's minus 250 degrees centigrade. Really cold. Very little noise. Okay, you've got this couple of degree beamless antenna aimed at the sun, and you've got this low noise front end running at 20 degrees Kelvin, looking at 6,000 degrees Kelvin called sun. Obviously the sun noise dominates. So for an hour or so around noontime, every day for about a week, your satellite system goes blank, goes dead. And the only way to get around that, as Paul was indicating, would be to take something like a Tejas satellite, which is in Earth orbit. You'd have to put it in solar orbit and put it a quarter or a half of a year ahead of us in solar orbit to look behind the sun to see Mars, to pick up these signals from Curiosity and these other spacecraft on Mars and relay them down to Earth. And although there's a couple of satellites we've got out there, they were not equipped for that function. Let me drop. So picture what it would be like if you had sent a man to Mars. And sometime during that mission, Mars will go behind the sun. And so for about a month, you're out of communication with Earth. And if something real bad happens that time, during that time, and you need some good communication from Earth, there's no easy way around that. But as you guys have heard me say so often, I'm reasonably convinced in our lifetime we're not going to be sending a man to Mars. So some noise is something you got to worry about. Let's see now. Stereo. Okay, that's the satellite that in theory is in the right position in solar orbit that it could help us. But I personally use the sun as a antenna range. Let me drop it. When I built that 12-foot stress diameter dish to build it, to listen to the Apollo astronauts on the moon, is what I decided to do later on. I originally built it just to be competitive in a 1296 megahertz antenna gain competition held by the East Coast VHF Society at Trenton State College in New Jersey. So I built this 12-foot diameter dish. You can read about it in August QST magazine, 1972, if you go back to the archives, the ancient material. And so that dish, to know that it was working correctly electronically, every focusing device usually has a so-called near-field range. You take your binoculars, and for a whole bunch of reasons, you probably can't focus them any closer than 10 or 15 feet. Otherwise, things are out of focus. Well, when it comes to a parabolic dish antenna, it's got some of that characteristic. Inside of a certain range, it behaves differently. It becomes difficult to measure the antenna pattern or the gain. The calculated near-field range of the 12-foot dish at 2 gigahertz was 700 feet. In other words, you put that antenna on an antenna range less than 700 feet long, like 500 feet, 300 feet, you'll come up with the wrong answer for its gain and its pattern, because things are out of focus that close. So I needed an antenna range of 700 feet long. There is now one antenna range. Oh, no. That's only 300 feet. The internal anechoic chamber, the biggest chamber on planet Earth that I know of, at Edwards Air Force Base, and I worked on that chamber way back in 1990, is only 310 feet end to end. It ain't big enough to test my dish. So I needed an antenna range 700 feet long. I used the universe. The sun was like 30 degrees above the horizon. I aimed the antenna at the sun, measured sun noise as if that was a transmitter, and then swept the antenna.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I then swept the antenna back and forth in azimuth and elevation to find out what did the antenna pattern look like. And I found out where there should be one peak, there were two peaks. Because the error in the surface, when you bend these spokes into a bow shape by strings at the end, that's the way this stressed parabolic antenna worked. These are all 6 foot long spokes, sort of the antenna was 12 foot long in diameter, all being bent from the center by a fishing string, 130-pound test Dacron fishing string at the end, pulling the ends toward the center, and that gives you a nearly parabolic shape. But when you cantilever load a spoke that way, you don't get a parabolic shape, you get something a little bit different. And that error made the antenna pattern at 2 gigs have two peaks instead of one peak. Discovered that phenomenon, made a template, held it up against the antenna, found out where the error was in the spokes, and bent them with the absolute error curve. And these are half-inch diameter pieces of tubing, 18 of them, with the spokes on this round parabolic dish. I bent them in the opposite direction to correct for the error, and the problem went away. So the sun noise measurement I did using the universe as an antenna range did that for you. So I guess to a small degree I was a radio astronomer way back in 1969 when I did that. And as I said, that article was reported in 1971. Space is interesting stuff, and you ain't seen nothing yet. Just wait till we put up that James Webb Space Telescope, somewhere around 2018, which is many times larger than Hubble, and operating at infrared so that it can see through the dust of the dark matter, and really give you a nice picture of those black holes that are probably in the center of every galaxy. And some of those black holes are just out of sight in size. 17 billion solar mass.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's really hard to imagine. And so, because of the way a black hole works, when you have enough mass in one spot, giving you a strong enough amount of gravity, that the escape velocity is greater than the speed of light. That's one of the definitions of a black hole. nothing can come back out of there. Okay? Right after the Big Bang of this universe, all of the matter of this universe was all, in theory, in one spot. More than enough gravity in one spot where the escape velocity is greater than the speed of light, therefore nothing can leave. And yet there's lots of evidence that the expansion of the Big Bang did take place. So we got a paradox. I asked that exact question at Stony Brook last Friday night, and the answer was, we don't know. I speculated that, okay, later on as the universe cooled and all of this premortal soup slowly converted itself into electrons, protons, and neutrons, slowly started forming molecules, slowly started forming dust clouds that formed planets and solar systems and eventually galaxies. Somewhere along the line, the Higgs boson was created, and therefore stuff suddenly had gravity. You could come up with a theory like that. So the Higgs boson didn't exist in the beginning, gravity didn't exist in the beginning, mass didn't exist in the beginning. Who knows? Got a lot to find out. Anybody have any further questions for Paul on what NASA is doing and what Paul knows about space? Give us your call letters right now. KQRIW in the TechNet.
N2SLW with a quick comment.
Is that N2 Sierra Lima Whiskey? Started your name, sir, and go right ahead with your comment.
Yeah, Dick, after the Big Bang, if one happened and there were no particles, there was no mass.
Yeah, but you got to... Okay, I'll go to Paul in a minute. You got to start off with something in order to make the particles. You can't make them out of nothing, is my feeling on the subject. But I ain't sure. Paul, you got an answer for that? Is that who it was? You got a Paul.
Yes, that was me, but I was going to comment on the James Webb, but as far as that goes, yeah, I've read that when it expanded, it went faster than the speed of light, but you got to remember, it wasn't expanding into anything. I mean, space itself wasn't created. It's not like it was traveling through space, you know, after it blew up. I mean, when it blew up, what was inside was what you see as space today, but what was on the outside wasn't, so those laws don't apply. I don't know, I've read that. I was talking about James Webb, you mentioned that. There's a room that they have set up, they used to test the Apollo spacecraft, all kinds of stuff inside this gigantic room, and it's a big facility. I think it's 120 feet tall. The door itself is 40 feet tall. It weighs, I don't know how many tons. And they evacuate the air completely out of this chamber. They're going to put the James Webb inside that thing. And all parts of it to run tests. And they're setting this all up now. Now it just pulled back, and now they have it to bring it down to I forget what temperature Kelvin, 5, 6, 7 degrees, some very low temperature Kelvin, to duplicate it. And they want to leave it in there for 90 days to make sure everything works, to make sure the mirrors and everything don't bend or move or whatever. Make sure the electronics work. Yeah, what state this is in. I remember. But back to you, Dick.
I personally saw at least one of those chambers, Paul, at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. I think it is 3 stories tall. It's in the middle of the building, and in the center of the building, some of the stories of the building are missing for this space simulator chamber, which, as I said, I think it's around 3 stories tall. You can put your spacecraft in there, evacuate the air, and then turn on the solar simulators. They got the xenon or whatever it is, light sources in there, which simulate the sun. And the running of that chamber, I believe I heard that the local town has to be informed 24 hours ahead of time so that the power company can tool up for the fact that the Goddard Space Flight Center is about to draw a tremendous gob of electrical energy in order to run this chamber. But I think it's the one that's at Goddard in Maryland. Does that sound right, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, this three stories would be, what, 30, 40 feet high? This is 120 feet high. I don't know if it's, I thought it was in Ohio. I'll have to look, I don't know. I know they had a setup like that. In fact, that might be the one where they also set up vibration, vibration tables. They also shake the electronics, the vacuum. Whatever space this is, whatever room this is, when they evacuate the air, the room is now 50,000 pounds lighter. The air itself in this room weighs 50,000 pounds. Back to you, Dick.
That's a very interesting number, because air has a mass of 2.7 pounds per cubic meter. You ask your average science enthusiastic friend, engineering friend, the air that's in your room with you right now, what does it weigh? What does 1 cubic meter of it weigh? And you've heard me say so often that the average person will say, how the hell do you weigh that? And the answer is you start off with a very strong steel box, 1 cubic meter, or a fraction of that, put it on a scale and weigh it, and put it on a vacuum pump, take the air out and weigh it again. 2.7 pounds per cubic meter, 1.2 kilograms per cubic meter. So 50,000 pounds tells us exactly the volume of that chamber. And it's a little shy of 15,000 cubic meters. That's a biggie. Air is very heavy stuff. Because it's so low in viscosity, because you wave your hand in it and it moves out of the way so easily, you think it's very light. I think I told you guys that the average engineer, I asked that question, what is 1 cubic meter of air weigh? The right answer is, what is it? The right question is, what is its mass? And the average engineer guesses around a milligram. A milligram is what they guess. The answer is 1.2 kilograms. Therefore, the answer is wrong by more than a million to one. Low. The fact that so many smart people give an answer a million to one wrong on something so basic as what is the air in the room with you weigh, pounds per cubic meter, tells me that there's some fairly big holes in the educational system, the way we're taught. By the same token, many of the things we're taught, like the equation PV equals NRT in your thermodynamics course, that
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
That equation tells you how much, and you memorize it, but it doesn't tell you how or why. The bottom of your bicycle pump gets hot. You ask the average guy why, you'd be amazed the answers you get, which are not even close. And the books don't tell you that. The book will, by way of the equation, the book will tell you, you tell me how much you're changing the volume of the air in the bottom of the bicycle pump as you're pushing down on the handle and the piston is compressing the air. You can calculate ahead of time how hot it's going to get. And Edmund Scientific and a few other places will show you this little plastic piston pump-like thing where you put a small piece of paper in this clear plastic piece of tubing, and you slap your hand down on the plunger, which compresses the air inside, and the piece of paper inside will instantaneously go into fire. The bottom of your bicycle pump, you can easily be compressing the air by a 4-to-1 ratio. That doubles the absolute temperature. It goes from 290 Kelvin to 580 Kelvin. That's a few times the temperature of boiling water. Happens in an instant when you press down on the pump. That equation tells you how much. It doesn't tell you why. And I'm a little bit unhappy about the fact that so few people have the curiosity to ask why. How did that happen? Why did those air molecules suddenly decide to move at twice their previous velocity? They were moving 500 meters per second in normal room temperature. 1.5 times the speed of sound is the average velocity, average speed of the air molecules in the room with you right now. At the bottom of that bicycle pump, they're moving twice as fast as that, 1,000 meters per second. Which is what? 3 times the speed of sound is the average speed of the air molecules in the bottom of your bicycle pump.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I just got real curiosity about science. 1,000 meters per second of the air molecules in the bottom of your bicycle pump. Who did that? Why did that happen? And it's not because they're bumping against each other. Every air molecule is bumping against every other air molecule, and that bump is a perfect bounce. Absolutely no energy loss. That's not it. Something else is going on. I think I got an answer, but it's not in the books that I've read. A number of my electrical puzzles are like that also. The answers are not in the books that we've read. How an antenna radiates. None of the books explain that. Right, here's the equations that you've got to use to make the antenna work. You memorize this equation for wavelength versus frequency and the speed of light and the thickness of the wire and the impedance you get and the impedance matching network and whatever. But why does it really radiate? We hams really appreciate the fact that you put a signal into an antenna, it goes off into space into every possible direction, and you could be running your transmitter in some cases on flashlight batteries or pen light cells, very little bit of energy. You do something with a simple piece of wire as an antenna here, and the guy a few thousand miles away hears you doing that and talks back to you. At first, that's a lot of magic. It's the magic of wireless that enthralls an awful lot of us, and that's why we're here. That's why we're in this crazy hobby. It's one of the basic forms of science, from my point of view, electromagnetic radiation. The sun is doing that. It's how all of that... The sun is giving you 10 to the 27 power watts of energy every instant. 10 to the 27 joules per second is flowing out of that sun. And by radio-like procedure, that energy flows through the hard vacuum of space between sun, hits the earth, gives us the heat, light, life.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Without that phenomenon, we wouldn't be here. So I'm also glad it takes place. What is it? Yeah, we can talk about the solar wind. Those are some of the particles flowing out of the sun. Lots of them. But even without the solar wind, the heat would still get here. That electromagnetic radiation. It doesn't consist of particles per se. Now you can call it photons. And we can talk about the photons and mass wave relationship of electromagnetic wave. Is it a particle or is it a wave? And the answer is yes. Somewhere between the two. Crazy stuff. And lots to be learned. Okay. I think we've answered all the questions of the people who signed in. I think we've gone through John's mailbag and Paul's space report. And now we're ready for the deeper subjects. So, fire away. Who's got the deeper subject? KQLIW.
Before we get deeper, WB2EAV.
Go ahead, Ed. You got an answer to all these crazy things that I don't know about? You got it, Ed.
No, but maybe I can help your frustration. You're very frustrated that nobody knows what airways. In an old auto mechanics class, I learned that the proper mixture of gasoline and air to burn in a car engine is 15 to 1 air to gas by weight. I further learned a gallon of gas requires enough air to fill a decent sized room to burn. And it's fairly straightforward to go through the arithmetic to come up with some idea of the weight of air.
Very good, Ed. It's a backdoor calculation. It's doing it in the inverse manner, but it's as good as any other. I mean, it doesn't have to be exact. There's many places in life where knowing the approximate order of magnitude is good enough. When Dave, N2APG, is on one of his hikes in the woods, if he happened to run into a grizzly bear or a brown bear, he doesn't have to know whether the animal is 300 pounds or 500 pounds. All he knows is that it's big, it looks at him as a chunk of food, and he better be moving in the other direction or he's about to become a meal. Just knowing approximately how big is good enough. So 15 to 1 ratio by weight of air to gas, and the gasoline itself is probably, 7 3/4 pounds per gallon, Therefore, you can figure out the room full might be a little shy, as I see it, Ed. Have you actually done the calculation of the average size room? That might be a pretty large room, because you and I have seen a fraction of a gallon of gasoline run a lawnmower for an hour, and that lawnmower is sucking in a lot of air in that engine, running continuously for that hour, and that's just a fraction of a gallon in that machine. And you think that's only a room full of air. I'm going to go through that calculation, Ed. I'm a little bit afraid it's going to be more than an average size room. Maybe in the in your size house, but my house, the rooms ain't quite that big, Ed. I said V2EAV, KQLIW.
Maybe in the teacher's house.
Now, what do you mean by a teacher's house? Is a teacher's house more empty or has bigger rooms? What are you saying, Ed? I'll wait for the beeps and give us an answer. You got it, Ed.
No, the guy who was teaching the course, maybe in his house.
Yeah, he said a room full of air. He may have meant a house full of air. I'm going to check on that. I believe the 15-to-1 ratio by weight and by volume has got to be huge. Well, we can also figure that out. I know approximately the mass density of gasoline and the mass density of air, so we can figure it out. So if I get a chance, I'm gonna check on that one. I've also only done order of magnitude. I could easily be wrong by 2-to-1 when I say that in 1 year, you and I consume an amount of air, liquid, and food that has the mass of your house. Very rough rule of thumb. It takes a lot of material to maintain a human being. We keep forgetting about the fact we're continuously breathing. Even when you're sleeping, you're breathing 6 liters of air per minute. And when you're working hard, you can go 100 liters of air per minute. Numbers like that. So lots of stuff is flowing through us in liquid, gaseous, and solid form. And all of that, every single molecule going through that human being becomes thoroughly recycled on this planet. You may have to wait 100 years for some of it, but it all gets recycled. And you try to maintain that man in space, the heroics you've got to go to give him the raw materials to stay alive and be happy. Whoa, ain't easy. And when I say the liquid gas and air, I mean compressed gas in cylinders stuffed into your house. The air in your house would not maintain you for a year. No way in hell. But in compressed cylinders, maybe. I gotta double check that. It takes a lot to maintain us. You're a little more efficient than me, but maybe it doesn't take as much to maintain you, Ed. Can it be to EAV, KQLIW?
They're asking about how much water I take in a day.
Is it more than 3 or 4 liters, Ed? Go ahead. In other words, you're one of these guys walking around with a water bottle, continuously sipping on it. And if so, you're one of the safe guys, one of the really healthy guys. Go ahead, Ed.
Wait a minute. Somebody else have something? Comment.
Yeah, Ed first, and then we'll pick up comments. Go ahead, Ed.
I once had to do a 24-hour urine sample. I filled up a 3-liter jug in 20 hours.
I think you're talking about not what you were consuming, but what came out of you as an effluent. Wow. You are a blank. You plug in the word. Go ahead with comments. Start off with your call letters and your name, sir. KQLIW.
Yeah, well, even in scuba diving, they have the rebreathers, and some are semi-closed circuit, some are closed circuit. So you really need a very small amount of oxygen, and because you're taking in so much of it at any one time, you're not using all of it. So it's with space. I mean, they're basically, if they're not using a on how many atmospheres pressure you're under. So if you're up in Colorado or you're down 33 feet, you know, you've got atmospheres, and you're going to use more oxygen at any one time. Back to net.
Yeah, you may have given your cold news in the beginning, and the machine didn't pick up right away, so I'm not quite sure. I am guessing that the human being consumes the same number of grams of oxygen per minute. And so you've got to be breathing faster at high altitude to get that many grams of oxygen in order to carry on your metabolism. That's a guess on my part. So the real grams of consumption are relatively steady. And one of the sobering thoughts I came to recently is that if you're doing a walk across Antarctica, there was a person, a very enthusiastic person, a decade or so ago, that took this very large sleigh of food and consumables and a tent and whatever, and decided to walk across Antarctica. And my goodness, is that heroic. I mean, if you run out of fuel to heat your soup, you would say, gee, life's going to get uncomfortable. Well, you also need that fuel to melt the ice and the snow around you in order to make that drinkable water. You'd say, gee, I'm getting thirsty. I've run out of fuel. I'll just pick up a handful of snow or ice, put it in my mouth, melt it and drink it. Sounds good. You'd be amazed what an investment you make to do that. You're taking minus 40 degree frozen water. You warm it up until 0 degrees centigrade, so the ice goes from the solid form to the liquid form. Your body has to instill 80 calories per gram to convert it from solid to liquid. Then you have to give it another, each gram of water, you have to give it another 37 calories to bring it up to 37 degrees centigrade so your body can use it. So that frozen water, you're making a huge investment to convert it from the frozen form that you get it until your body can use it. The same.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
If you're just sitting steady and not even doing hard work, and you're breathing air at minus 40, your trachea and your lungs have to warm up that air to 98 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 degrees centigrade, before your body can use it. So you're making a big investment. And your breath coming out of you, you see all that fog coming out of you. That's moisture that your body has given up, because that air happens to be very dry. So you're continuously evaporating the moisture in your body. You're continuously giving away heat of your body. It has to stay at 98 for you to be, you know, behaving normally. So you run out of fuel. It's almost as bad as running out of food. You run out of either one. No matter how good the insulation is on you, as your body's temperature starts dropping, you ain't alive anymore. So it's a pretty wicked environment by my standards. And the physics of that, I'm not sure everyone understands that before they launch into those kind of procedures. Lots of people who are camping on the mountains, not realizing you can get some very sudden changes in weather. Let me drop. You better be very well equipped clothing-wise. You better be very well equipped water and food-wise. You better be very well equipped with a cell phone and spare batteries, so that you have the opportunity to holler mayday if something goes wrong. If not, you can become history awful easily. And those beautiful mountains can become lethal. The towers that we amateurs build, you've got to be very careful in those. They can become lethal. And I'm a tower owner for 45 years, and I've learned some procedures on how to stay alive on those. And we've all done some silly things from time to time, and we're lucky that we got away with it. And with any further questions on all of the above, give me a call. That is right now, KQLIW.
Dick, I think Wesley signed in with a question, didn't he?
Okay, Wes, go ahead with your question, Wes.
To Nick and to LDY. Let's take that into LDY with the question first.
And I heard something Yankee. Who is the something Yankee person?
Nobody, what are you doing? It's LDY.
Okay, Doug. Doug, I think you're overmodulating. You're extremely distorted. WA2SAY, so back off a long distance from that mic and try it again. And I hope you don't have 5 KC of error in the frequency. But the HRSA1, K2LAW. Go ahead, Doug. I only heard 2 syllables, Doug. Double-check your frequency. I'm also going to go look on 975-375, which I believe is what you're using, and see if I can hear you any better. W-H-O-S-A-Y, try again, K2-R-I-W. W-H-O-S-A-Y, K2-R-I-W. Give it one more try, Doug.
W-H-O-S-A-Y, do you copy better now?
Fantastic improvement. What did you do?
I just wanted to tell you that gasoline weighs 6 pounds per gallon.
Wow. I knew it was lighter than water. I didn't know it was that much lighter. 6 pounds per gallon. That's a good round number, Doug. Water is 8 pounds per gallon. Gasoline is 6 pounds per gallon. Wow. Back to you. And that's a much better sounding radio. To B-H-O-S-A-Y, K-2-L-I-W.
Okay, that comes from the Airman's Information Manual, which is published by the government, I guess. And that's what you use when you're calculating weight and balance of fly. So that's where the number comes from. And it may be slightly rounded up, but I can't be off by very much.
Good to know, and thank you, Doug. Don and 2LDY, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Okay, good evening, Dick. Well, I was thinking, you know, so let's say down in Antarctica there, I mean, if you were able to bring along, like, some type of a little solar oven, I'm sure that most days you would have an abundance of solar energy to do that, or maybe, you know, one of those concave mirrors, magnify the light and heat your water, or heat, you know, convert the ice into water. I bet you that would be something that you might want to think about, right?
Except in winter.
Yeah, it's worth a try, Don and John. Well, a smart person is not going to work across Antarctica in the winter. And a large enough mirror to gather enough solar energy, and the amount of sunlight that hits the North Pole, the South Pole, and the equator is essentially the same as long as the parabolic mirror is really aimed at the sun on a clear day. But you get a lot of cloudy days in Antarctica. You get a lot of days with 40-knot winds. And trying to heat water in a solar telescope where you've got a few meters of mirror and a 40-knot wind. And also the mass of that thing. It's wind load and it's mass. You've got to carry it on your sleigh, the sledge or whatever it's called. It's an approach. It's not ideal. And maybe you have the right kind of a mirror that can be folded up when you're transporting it. But that's worth a try. There's very little other sources of energy you've got in that environment. Sunlight, I guess, is it. Everything else around you is frozen. Tough way to go. Okay, yeah. Wes, you got it. N2XJN, K2LIW in the second hand.
N2XJN. The subject is related to the recent experiments that I was doing with non-radioactive compound using radio waves. Again, I was able to create activation of the compound. The tube was about 5 millimeters in diameter and 45 millimeters long. To contain a copper, zinc, cadmium, a few other stuff. And then I was thinking, how is it possible? I went to the history as I was working on Coleman patent from 1956, and I found that Henry Schott in 1926 created a device at which, let's jump. At which he hide a coil from the Tesla battery of his time. Then I went to Thomas Edison in 1901 and I found out that the structure, chemical structure of that rod is very much like the structure of Coleman. Then I went further. In 2008, Andrea Rossi, you can Google for that guy. Andrea Rossi is the guy, John viewed the material about Andrea Rossi, who developed a device that is producing 10 kilowatts of power within 1 hour using 1 gram of nickel. Actually, John could give you more information about it. The guy has a criminal record in Sicilia. And then after John, quick comment, I will give you what I'm trying to talk about. John?
You want me to take it, Dick?
Yeah, I think maybe you're going to describe what you saw in the so-called Rossi YouTube video. I got a bit of an impression from it. Maybe you got an impression from it. And I know that there are people speculating that one of the sources of energy out of this apparatus is that nickel is being transmuted into copper. And that's a little bit of a problem, because if it was fusion of nickel into copper, the good books will tell you that that is a energy absorbing reaction, not an energy emitting reaction. As you climb the periodic table up to iron, fusion gives you energy. Beyond iron, you don't get energy coming out. You have to put energy in. So that in itself wouldn't be an explanation. Now, it would be nice to think it was some kind of a rediscovery of real cold fusion, that nickel can be converted to copper by cold fusion. But that takes energy going in, not coming out. So it's not easy. Mr. Rossi, I know, and he's got some people making some pretty big investments, saying that they think that this apparatus that they only partially understand has merit, and they're willing to invest in building, I think he said he's going to build 100,000 of them in a year or two. So if all of that's true, that's putting your money where your thoughts or where your mouth is. It's getting serious. KC2WGB, what was your impression, John? K2RIW?
Oh, exactly the same, Dick. It seems that the nickel is getting a proton delivered to it. And there was one guy there who did claim cold fusion. And it is done, instead of with RF measure energy, it is done by heating it. So, again, you know, no real data there, but that's the way they're going. And he said that they can build, the Greeks said they can build and assemble and produce 300,000 a year in production. So, and they're going to be approximately $2,000 a piece. And you're going to rent them, by the way. So that's about all I know about it, Dick. But I saw the same thing you did. KC2WGB.
Thank you very much, John. And to XGM. The device of Andrea Rossi with 1 gram of nickel powder and hydrogen within 1 hour produced 10 kilowatts power in 24 hours. It used only 1 gram of hydrogen, but in 180 days used about 150 grams of nickel, which comes to 60 cents of total cost for 180 days. What I found out, is that Hendershot from 1926, Coleman from 1956, Andrea Rossi from 2008, and I, we use exactly very much similar way to get the result. The activation is being done with the radio waves. The structure of the compound in terms of Hendershot and Coleman is very much alike. Andrea Rossi took advantage only of one feature of the process, which is the heat exchange, as Coleman was directly trying to extract the radio energy. The device must be charged 15 seconds every hour to give for 30 milligrams about 1.1 kilowatt hour for the next hour. If it's 300 milligrams, which is 3 grams, it will give 10 kilowatts of hour. And 10 times more will be equal, in a mass calculation, to 100 kilowatts per hour. That lead me to another suspicion.
Graham.
DK. Presented many times a device of different power in front of me. He presented 200 watts, then he presented 2 kilowatts, and the most he presented 100 kilowatts. The device was connected to the small 9-volt battery for a period of few seconds, and then 15 seconds, 20 seconds, 1 minute, and then the device was by itself not connected to any power supply. If we could go with that imagination further, we could assign that TK was hiding Coleman tube inside. I found very much common parts into it. Andrea Rossi used aluminum foil around his 10 kilowatt very small device, and John would be able to give you a little bit more description how the device looks like. This device, which is aluminum, is perfectly shielding better radiation. And then I went further to tritium and to beta voltaic, and for the manufacturers of batteries based on radioactive isotope, which the compound that I have used is 100% non-radioactive. And I found that the beta-voltaic batteries and batteries using radioactive isotopes are being used for peacemakers. And this subject is pretty much hot. The end of the story is that Andrea wants to use a secret ingredient. And he didn't want it to reveal this to screen it, but his patent application that he filed, it doesn't have that secret ingredient listed in the patent, might possibly be revoked by the priority of Coleman. And I believe that I have a very much idea what is the secret ingredient in Andrea Rossi device, as he is using only one part of the process, the heat exchange. And to Andrea.
The number of grams of nickel being consumed, the number of grams of hydrogen being consumed, by normal chemical reactions, we can give you anywhere near that amount of power, something like 10 kilowatts for 24 hours. By chemical reaction, we're off by orders of magnitude.
150 grams for 180 days.
Yeah, that's by normal chemical reactions, oxidation, reduction reactions, you're not going to get anywhere near that amount of energy. That suggests that the only way it could be operating, if there aren't other secret ingredients that we don't know about going into the process, you would think is nuclear fusion or fission. And if it's nuclear fusion or fission, you would think you would see radioactivity being experienced. And now, the process by which normally you do fusion or fission requires tremendous resources that are not present here. To get a particle to penetrate the nucleus of another element, and therefore to add a proton in order to do transmutation. Nickel will become copper if you can add another proton. But to get that proton into the nucleus requires tremendous resources. You can't just say, I want you to go there. You can't just do it by heating. So, and even if you did, if you transmuted nickel to copper, energy flow is in the wrong direction. That requires energy as opposed to giving off energy. So to get get these kinds of magnitudes requires a nuclear-like process, and John and I and others are having trouble seeing what kind of a nuclear process is taking place with those resources. So you can't blame us, Wes, for being a bit skeptical at this time. From what we see, from what numerical evidence being given, it sounds awfully good, and if the concept has been here since 1926 or 2008, whichever, or 1956, whichever one you want to look at, it's also curious that a lot of them don't seem to exist in the world at this time. Back to you, Wes, and to XJN, Kate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You got it, Wes.
Yeah, I was on the subject of transportation for a long period of time, and I found also another route of coincidence, which was kind of interesting for me, to me, from not political perspective, but from the perspective of just progress. In 1980, John Hutchison made his experiment of transportation, and he shows, at least, the evidence of anti-gravity. And Eric Dorrard confirmed that, surprisingly, both of those phenomena are very tightly related. Then, in 1981-82, I'm not sure about it, John Hutchison was visited by Pentagon, at least based on his words. And he's got the paper that he shows in front of the audience from the Army, standing the fact of Army being interested with it. Supposedly, the poor scientists from Army were staying in his lab for 4 months. Some time after that, his lab was confiscated. Of course, I'm not in the conspiracy theory. I don't care about it. It is just few things. Somebody can dig in it. I don't. Then, in 1988, Fort Mammoth in New Jersey was experimenting with the transmutation of the ferret. And, of course, extracting energy of the ferret. In 2 years ago, I was in Lithuania, and I was doing a Lithuania experiment with a yolk that came from the Russian Rubin TV, and in front of my house, we were able to extract the energy from it, delivering active milliwatts because of the mismatch of impedance from two generators. At that time, I didn't really understand why I have had so much of the side effects, which was the headache that was staying, remaining for the period of 1 week after I came back from Lithuania. And then I look at the possible structure of the Russian yolks used in TVs, and I find out the ingredients pretty much correlating to Coleman device. Then my understanding would be that Army had the purpose of transmutating the ferrite. And further down, there was a Dr. Judy Wood that was interested with transmutation, and she was pointing the transmutation power for a scientific reason that was sort of political, but I don't want to go into it. There are too many things and too much notions around it. My primary question to you, Dick, is how come radio wave, and this is a fact, so it's not that I'm thinking that it's working, it works based on, this, let's say, the Army experiment from 1988 and to next year. How come the radio wave is able to transmutate the physical gradients of the material? The physical crystalline structure has to be changed.
radio waves. Milliwatts. Not watts, not kilowatts. Milliwatts. I've seen that. I've been there. I've done that. By myself. Okay? Now, if then we see that the similar pattern with Hendershot and Coleman, and then Andrea Rossi, we see that something must begin. How come the radio wave is able to activate the compact? Enter here.
A radio wave definitely has what many people will call magic when it's radiated into free space. If I've got some kind of a very simple antenna on top of my tower, and over on top of your building, you put some kind of a fairly simple antenna, and I transmit a few watts of signal, and you receive that few watts of signal, and in between, no particles are flowing. Some energy is being transferred, and radio does that. That's a bit of magic in free space. But in a laboratory, when I conduct it with near-field antennas and wires, what we call radio is just a sine wave signal at a higher than normal frequency, higher than audio, but raising the frequency doesn't necessarily create magic. Inside of my microwave oven, the water gets heated because each one of those water molecules is a polar molecule, and every one of those polar molecules flips back and forth on each half cycle of the RF energy in that microwave oven. And the process, the fact that it does it with a phase lag, a hysteresis loop, so to speak, is the method by which energy is converted. And what's really happening at the molecular level, let me drop.
KC2QIQ with a comment on this one too, Dick.
Yeah, the water gets heated because the water molecules are continuously bouncing against each other, but they're rotating at the same time they're bouncing. Therefore, when I've got a rotation of a lumpy object and a bounce, after the bounce, I've got more energy than I went in. That's the heating mechanism from my point of view. So RF energy, sine wave, can do heating. But heating alone doesn't give you a magic reaction. I can do that heating. I can do the same amount of heating with a Bunsen burner that I do with a microwave oven. And I don't think one is very different than the other as far as the way the substance being heated behaves. Glenn, you probably got a way of looking at this, and let's see how you look at it. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, the tech man.
Good question, Dick.
Okay, Glenn first, and then John in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of experimenting with ferrite over the years, and I've probably operated ferrite materials from frequencies as low as, let's say, 5 kilohertz. Actually lower than that, because I've even used, steels and supermunders and other materials all the way down probably to, let's say, 20 to 100 hertz, even in audio transformers. So I've worked with those materials through there. I've worked with ferrites, ceramic, iron, steel, nickel. I've done the magnet materials, the cobalts, neodymiums, alnico. I've worked with, how many other materials? Manganese. All of these materials are extremely stable to frequencies, let's say, from hertz to, I would say, at least 1 gigahertz. Let me let it drop for a second. And when I say stable, what I mean is that when you apply RF energy or sine wave energy through these materials, there's only... basically, you're going to get a certain magnetic field flux with the coil that's wrapped around these materials. But the only other side effect that you get from the material itself is heat, as Dick had mentioned. For all these materials, and you can observe this, on all the data sheets for these materials especially, you have a thing called hysteresis loss. So as the frequency goes up, you achieve heating. So